Flowers rarely come more extraordinary and varied than those in the orchid family, as Professor Kathy Willis, the Director of Science at the Royal Botanic Gardens, Kew, now discovers as she takes up her story of our changing relationship with the plant kingdom, in plants from roots to riches.
They come in an infinite variety of shapes, smells and sizes. They can make themselves look like a bee, smell of vanilla, pretend to be a fungus, or produce extraordinary flowers exactly the right size and shape for a moth with a 10-inch tongue. Small wonder then that the annual Orchid Festival at Kew is one of its most popular public events. Emma Townsend, a tour leader at the festival, is well aware of the appeal of the orchid family.
It has this fantastic, exotic, sometimes it's sexual connotation to the flower. Some people just want to go and look at the incredibly colourful kind of vandas. They're hanging down
the
from
the... blousy ones.
Yes. And for some people, just to put their face up to an orchid and smell in that perfume, you just can see that their day has really been changed.
Orchids are big business. Over £5 million worth of orchids are imported as cut flowers into the UK each year. You can find luridly coloured cloned hybrids in the flower section on the shelves of your local supermarket, and vanilla pods in the baking section. At the same time, because it's such a varied family, some of the stranger examples are extremely rare and precious. The earliest orchids arrived on British shores in 1731, and by the Victorian era had become a true botanical celebrity. James Bateman published his gigantic book on the orchids of Mexico and Guatemala in 1843, lavishly illustrated and full of travellers' tales and tips on cultivation. Bateman called orchids the chosen ornaments of royalty, neatly capturing the allure of the potent mixture of imperial conquest and scientific discovery. By the mid-19th century, Britain and the rest of Europe were in the grip of orchid mania. But as historian Jim Endersby explains, like other manifestations of Western imperialism, the results were far from benign for the local population.
There's a rather vivid and rather distressing example of this when Joseph Hooker is travelling in India in the 1840s. He actually writes home to tell his father, William, that he has witnessed orchid collecting on a kind of grand scale, to the extent that the area looks as though a hurricane has blown through it, with twigs on the ground, the trees devastated by the collectors. And the collectors in question are actually working for the Calcutta Botanic Gardens. And these are, you know, obviously now we think of Botanic Gardens as being at the forefront of plant conservation worldwide, Kew in particular. In the 19th century, they're inadvertently contributing to the destruction of orchids on a grand scale. And, you know, if the Botanic Gardens seem a little reprehensible, the commercial collectors are 10 times worse. I've come across accounts of people talking about cutting down over 1,000 trees in order to get the orchids that are growing at the top of them, felling great swathes of a rainforest in order to find orchids. And other cases where very rare orchids are discovered by a collector, they collect as many as they can carry and then deliberately destroy as many of the remaining ones as possible to stop other collectors finding them. So there is a kind of orchid holocaust almost going on at this time because of this European lust for these exotic tropical flowers.
As the Victorian writer Charlotte M. Young commented in 1856, hothouses full of orchids were like
a picture in a dream. One could imagine it a fairyland where no care or grief or weariness could come.
Orchids are now known to be one of the most diverse families of plants. At Kew, we've 3,000 types growing in the nursery, which sounds a lot until you realise that this is little more than 10% of the known species worldwide. And even to house these different varieties, 6,500 square metres of glasshouse is needed and 21 different climate zones, from hot and humid to cold and dry, all carefully controlled under the management of Lara Jewett. And the number of species just keeps growing.
We're definitely finding new ones all the time, especially in countries that we haven't been into. So my colleague's recently been to Cambodia and they've collected and described a lot there. Obviously they have to be described before we know that they're new. So that's one way they come in. They come in as seed from other collections, and then when we flower them we realise that they're brand new, and the botanists will come and name them. And so that's very exciting. And then the last way is that if anything, any orchids are brought into Heathrow illegally, they'll come to Kew to be looked after while that case goes to court. So potentially they could be new species, and quite often are. That's why they have been collected illegally.
So we've got this fantastic diversity of orchids, both here at Kew and obviously in the world. What's it, 25,000 species?
Yeah, but what's really interesting is how important they are in the areas that they grow. There's the gongora, for example, it's from Brazil, and it's pollinated by the euglossum bee. Now, the euglossum bee goes to it to get a fragrance from it, and that fragrance attracts the female euglossum bee, so it's like an aftershave, if you like.
It's extraordinary. I mean, people think about insects doing this, don't they? But they never think about plants having a scent for other pollinators.
But what's really interesting is that it's the female bee that pollinates the Brazil nut. So it's that relationship. Without that orchid, you know, they wouldn't mate, that wouldn't go on, and then that nut wouldn't be produced.
The naturalist Charles Darwin was fascinated with this family. With Victorian orchid mania at its peak, the very next book he wrote after On the Origin of Species was about orchids. Given his interest in the science of how characteristics are passed down and bred into a species, we shouldn't be surprised that orchids provided him with a rich resource of study. He was fascinated too with insect pollination and fertilisation. Darwin begins working with native orchids on his home patch in Kent before moving on to tropical varieties. He deduces that most are dependent on a specific individual type of insect, one species matched to one flower, fitting together like a lock and key.
Darwin realises two very important things. One is that the traditional explanation for the exotic and extravagant beauty of flowers, which is that God made them to delight us, clearly doesn't hold. But what's much more interesting is that the theory of evolution by natural selection explains the bizarre diversity of orchid forms, because that's how you explain this lock and key fit between the insect and its flower. So if you imagine ancestors of orchids growing in the jungle, there's a whole variety of insects that can pollinate them because the orchids have a kind of common generic shape. If through random variation, some of the orchids develop, for example, a deeper throat, so that only insects with a long tongue can reach down into the orchid and get the nectar, what will happen is that a smaller number of insects will reach them, but their pollen will only be transferred to members of their own species. And most plants are infertile to the pollen of other species. So although you run the risk of not being pollinated at all because there are fewer potential pollinators, far less of your pollen gets wasted. Now, of course, the plants don't know this and they don't plan for this, but natural selection will favour this specialisation over time. And, of course, the insect, of course, evolves to fit the flower for exactly the same reasons. It gets exclusive access to the nectar, so it doesn't have to compete with other insects for the same food supply. And there is a lovely example. Darwin actually has an orchid from Madagascar, which he finds, which has an enormously deep flower. And he predicts that there must be a species of moth that fertilises this orchid, and only this orchid, and must have a tongue, I think he says, 10 inches long. No one has seen this moth, and it seems a fanciful suggestion. It's found a few years later, and it has the scientific name Predictor as a result, because Darwin foresaw that it must exist. So the orchids provide a wonderfully rich illustration of why natural selection is actually such a big success in the scientific community. For the men of science, it suggests new questions to ask and new ways to answer them, and a theory which allows them to make predictions and test them, something that actually natural history and botany have never had before. And it makes the life sciences, biology as it's increasingly going to be known, into a real science for the first time, something that has the kind of precision and the predictability that physics and other sciences have long had.
So the frail, delicate orchid plays its part in getting botany a seat at the top table of scientific respectability. But Darwin's discovery of these intensely localised relationships with pollinators also made clear that what makes orchids so successful as a family, their ability to adapt to many different environments, also makes individual species highly vulnerable to sudden changes in their local environment. Many are confined to a tiny area of just a few square metres or less. Each maintains a precarious foothold. Madagascar, home to Darwin's famous moth orchid, contains the greatest concentration of orchid species anywhere in the world. Many of them are at risk. At Kew, Conservation efforts are now underway to collect the seeds of these rare and threatened species and to cultivate and reintroduce them into the wild. Biswanbaram Saracen is head of conservation biotechnology at Kew.
In the area we are working, it is the Central Highlands that covers almost 40% of Madagascar's land mass. This area is very, very difficult to get to collect orchids, but at the same time, the problems are illegal mining, slash and burn agriculture. People illegally collect orchids from the wild.
So that's still going on then, there's some plant hunters.
So there are multitude of threats to these orchids in the wild. Say, for example, we have seen species where only two or three plants left in the wild, then there may be only two or three seed pods to collect. We don't collect all the seed pods, so we're forced to collect only one seed pod.
Right.
And just leave the rest for...
So very, very precious then, that one seed pod when you bring it back.
Exactly.
Successful cultivation from a few seeds can be achieved by micropropagation or growing in miniature. The collected seed pods are sterilised and sown onto the surface of a nutrient medium. With the correct temperature, light and moisture, the seeds can germinate within a few weeks. As Saracen explains, however, their research shows that effective cultivation of orchid seed also requires an understanding of its close relationship with fungi in the soil.
Orchid seeds in nature need a fungus for its germination. So that early stage is being helped by a mycorrhizal fungus.
So these are the fungus that grow around the roots system.
Exactly. What actually happens in the wild, once the mature seeds are dispersed, so it needs to find the right fungus for its germination.
What's the fungus supplying the plant with then?
Because the orchid seeds don't have an endosperm, that is a feeding tissue for the germinating embryo, the fungus come in as a sort of a feeding supporter, helping the seed to get the necessary nutrients. So what we do now is when we go and collect the seed capsules, we also collect mature roots of the same orchid. And then we bring the roots here. Then we isolate these fungal coils inside the roots and then culture them.
Have you got some examples in here then of orchids grown with and without the fungi?
Exactly. What we are looking here is, you know, one same orchid species which we collected from the wild with fully mature seeds.
So these are what, 5 centimetres across these little plastic
plates.
Pots?
Yeah.
And then they've got agar, is it agar gel inside
it
there?
Is,
that's your medium?
Yeah, it is a medium.
And one where you've got fairly vibrant looking little seedlings, and
exactly.
One where they've...
Only two there.
Two looking rather weedy, I have
exactly.
to say.
Actually, it is all the magic of the fungus, basically. So huge difference between
Massive.
Them. And also the quality of the plants.
So if you're thinking about restoring them in the wild, you absolutely need to have mycorrhizae in there to have a successful restoration of these orchids.
Exactly. We are producing these sort of symbiotic seedlings for a large-scale reintroduction or restoration work back to the wild. And when we go after 6 months or something, these plants should be still there, growing, happy.
Yeah.
Otherwise, whatever work we do wouldn't be complete.
So we have a paradox. This is the largest family of plants in the world that has beguiled millions of people over the centuries, but is also one of the most endangered. Interestingly, one of the most invasive species in the tropical rainforest is, in fact, an orchid. And it is this ability of this family to prosper anywhere that highlights a problem too, and one of which the Victorians in particular were becoming acutely aware. The impact on native plants by a growing population of newcomers, alien invasive species.
That was Professor Kathy Willis with Plants from Roots to Riches. The reader was Jane Slavin. The series is produced by Adrian Washbourne.